underneath the functioning drawbridge. Almost 40 years later, when I was in my early 50s, I purchased that photo as a collectible, and it still hangs in my house. The photographer, it turned out, was Deanne Arbus. I try to square the photo's breathtakingly romantic image with the rest of her extreme subject matter, and I assume she saw this facsimile of a castle as though it were a kitsch roadside statue of Paul Bunyan, or perhaps she saw it as I did. Beautiful. The Birdcage Theater. During the 1960s, the 5-foot-high hand-painted placard in front of the Birdcage Theater at Knott's Berry Farm read, "World's Greatest Entertainment." The missing N in entertainment was overlooked by staff, audience, and visitors for an entire decade. I worked there between the ages of 18 and 22 as an actor in melodramas. Knott's Berry Farm didn't have the flash of its younger sibling, Disneyland, but it was authentic and charming. Knott's Berry Farm began in the 1930s when Walter and Cordelia Knott put up a roadside berry stand. A few years later, Cordelia opened her chicken dinner restaurant, and Walter bought pieces of a ghost town and moved the old west buildings to his burgeoning tourist destination. Squawking peacocks roamed the grounds, and there was a little wooden chapel that played organ music while you stared at a picture of Jesus and watched his eyes magically open. My first performances for a paying audience were at the Birdcage, a wooden theater with a canvas roof. Inside, 200 folding chairs sat on risers, and a thrust Masonite stage sat behind a patch of fake grass. A painted cutout of a birdcage, worthy of a Sotheby's folk art auction, hung over center stage, and painted representations of drapes framed the proscenium. The actors swept the stage, raised and lowered the curtains, cleaned the house of trash, and went out on the grounds pitching the show to visitors strolling around the park. I was being paid $2 a show, 25 shows a week. Even in 1963, the rate was considered low. The show consisted of a 25-minute melodrama in which the audience was encouraged to cheer the hero and boo the villain. I appeared in The Bungling Burglar, performing the role of Hamilton Brainwood, a detective who was attracted to the provocatively named soubrette Dimples Reardon. Fortunately, I ended up with the virtuous heroine, Angela Trueheart. My opening night was attended by my high school girlfriend, Linda Rasmussen, and her parents, who, it turned out, were more nervous for me than I was. The play was followed by a 10-minute oleo segment involving 2 5-minute routines where the actors did their specialties, usually songs or short comedy acts. Though I didn't do an oleo that night, the Birdcage was the first place where I was able to work steadily on my magic act, 6 minutes at a time, 4 times a day, 5 on Sunday, for 3 years. The Birdcage was a normal theatrical nuthouse. Missed cues caused noisy pileups in the wings, or a missing prop left us hanging while we ad-libbed excuses to leave the stage and retrieve it. A forgotten line would hang in the dead air, searching for someone, anyone, to say it. The theater was run by Woody Wilson, a dead ringer for W.C. Fields, and a boozer, too, and the likable George Stewart, who, on Saturday night, would entertain the crowd with a monologue that had them roaring. "You're from Tucson? I spent a week there one night." 4 paying customers in a house that seated 200 was officially an audience, so we often did shows to resonating silence. Woody Wilson, on one of these dead afternoons, peed so loudly in the echoing bathroom that it broke up us actors and got laughs from our conservative family audience. The theater was stocked with genuine characters. Ronnie Morgan, Rail Finn, would dress up as Lincoln and read the Gettysburg Address for local elementary schools. On a good day, he would show us young lads cheesecake photos of his wife in a leopard-skin bikini, and even at age 18 we thought it was weird. There was Joe Carney, a blustery and funny actor who opened the lavatory door from the top to avoid germs. Paul Shackleton was the son of a preacher and could not tolerate a swear word, but he once laughed till he cried when we sat down under a eucalyptus tree to drink our cokes and a bird shit on my head. His laughter made me think it was funny, too, and for days we could not look each other in the eye without breaking into uncontrollable hysterics. John Stewart, a talented tenor with a mischievous sense of humor, once secretly put talcum powder in my top hat. On stage, whenever I popped the hat on or off, a mushroom cloud of smoke bloomed from my head, causing an unscheduled laugh from the audience. Kathy Westmoreland, Another actress at the theater had attended Garden Grove High School at the same time I did, and she was the first indisputably talented person I ever met. She sang like the Swedish Nightingale, and later in life achieved a strange kind of celebrity. As a backup singer for Elvis, she became his confidant and then quietly his lover. Years later, after his death, she wrote a book revealing her secret, making her the focus of overwrought Elvis fans. Kathy and I developed a hillbilly routine, she on washtub bass and I on banjo. It was my first foray into comedy without magic to back me up. She blacked out a tooth, and the act included crossed eyes and corny jokes, and it absolutely killed. We soon ascended to the premier slot for the Birdcage Olio Acts, the Saturday night 9 o'clock performance. The audience would howl and weep and thrash about, and the laughs would double the length of our 5-minute show. We decided to take our act to the Golden Bear for a Monday tryout. The Bear was a folk music club in Huntington Beach, California, where all the big names played, including Kenny Rankin, John Mayall, Jackson Brown, and Hoyt Axton, an accomplished performer and songwriter himself, author of the oddly unforgettable lyric, "Jeremiah Was a Bullfrog." But it's hard to forget that his mother co-wrote Heartbreak Hotel. I was smug about presenting our fully broken-in and seemingly invulnerable act. My belief in the inevitability of our success charged me up before, during, and after the show, and it was not until days later when I acknowledged to myself that our debut in the tougher world of real show business had been met with only polite response. Kathy and I were probably too corny for an exploding folk scene that was producing many serious and spectacular artists. The willing and forgiving audiences at the Birdcage did not necessarily reflect those at hip folk clubs. And then there was Stormy. Stormy Shirk, later to become an enormously successful Christian author and proselytizer under her married name Stormy O'Mardian, was beautiful, witty, bright, and filled with an engaging spirit that was not yet holy. We performed in plays together. My role was either the comic or the leading man, depending on the day of the week. She wore 19th-century style dresses that complemented her strawberry blonde hair and vanilla skin. Soon we were in love and would roam around knots in our period clothes and find a period place to sit, mostly by the period church next to the man-made lake, where we would stare endlessly into each other's eyes. We developed a love duet for the Birdcage in which she would sing Gypsy Rover while I accompanied her on the five-string. When she sang the song, the lyric that affected me most was, believe it or not, "La-dee-doo, la-dee-doo-dum day." We would talk of a wedding in a lilac-covered dale, and I could fill any conversational gaps with ardent recitations of Keats and Shelley. Finally, the inevitable happened. I was a late-blooming 18-year-old when I had my first sexual experience involving a condom swiped from my parents' drawer and the front seat of my car, whose windows became befogged with desire. Later, Stormy wrote in her autobiography that when she was a girl, her severely mentally ill mother would lock her in a dark closet for days, cruelly abusing her. I had no idea. If Stormy had said I would look good in a burgundy ball gown, I would have gone out and bought a burgundy ball gown. Instead, she suggested that I read W. Somerset Maugham's The Razor's Edge. The Razor's Edge is a book about a quest for knowledge, universal, final, unquestionable knowledge. I was swept up in the book's glorification of learning, and the idea that, like a stage magician, I could have secrets possessed by only a few. Santa Ana Junior College offered no philosophy classes, so I immediately applied to Long Beach State College, later renamed the loftier-sounding California State University at Long Beach, and enrolled with a major in philosophy. I paid for schooling out of my Birdcage wages, aided in my second year by a Dean's List scholarship, $180 a year, achieved through my impassioned studying, fueled by razor's edge romanticism. I rented a small apartment near school, so small that its street number was 1059 and a quarter. Stormy eventually moved an hour north to attend UCLA, and we struggled for a while to see each other. But without the metaphor of the 19th century to enchant us, we realized that our real lives lay before us, and, painfully for me, we drifted apart. At the Birdcage, I formed the soft, primordial core of what became my comedy act. Over the 3 years I worked there, I strung together everything I knew, including Dave Stewart's glove-and-a-dove trick, some comedy juggling, a few standard magic routines, a banjo song, and some very old jokes. My act was eclectic, and it took 10 more years for me to make sense of it. However, the opportunity for performing 4 and 5 times a day gave me confidence and poise. Even though my material had few distinguishing features, the repetition made me lose my amateur rattle. Catalyzed by the popularity of the folk group the Kingston Trio, small music clubs began to sprout in every unlikely venue. Shopping malls and restaurant cellars now had corner stage showrooms that sometimes did and sometimes didn't serve alcohol. There were no clubs dedicated to comedy. They did not exist for at least 15 years, so every comedian was an outsider. The Paradox in Tustin was where I first saw the Dillards, a bluegrass group that played hard and made us laugh too, and featured the whiz-bang 5-string banjo picker Doug Dillard, who looked like a grin on a stick but played with staggering speed and clarity. There was the Rouge et Noir in Seal Beach, where I saw David Troy, a.k.a. David Somerville, a.k.a. Diamond Dave, a singer-guitarist who had the ladies swooning and who had been, years earlier, the lead singer on the Diamonds' monster hit Little Darlin'. I didn't realize I was hearing one of the most famous voices in early rock and roll. At the Mecca in Buena Park, I saw the up-and-coming comedian Pat Paulson, who opened with this funny line, "I've had a great life, with the exception of 1959, when unfortunately I passed away." The best opening line I ever heard was from Sam Kinison. In the late 80s, playing the Comedy Store in Los Angeles, he said, "You're going to see a lot of comedians tonight. Some will be good, some will be okay, but there's a difference between me and them. Them, you might want to see again sometime." But wait, maybe the best opening line I heard was Richard Pryor's, after he started 2 hours late in front of a potentially miffed crowd at the Troubadour in Los Angeles. He said simply, "Hope I'm funny." Using the Birdcage as a home base, I flirted with outside work, auditioning for gigs while keeping my class load at school as light as possible. The Prison of Socrates was a music club in the T-shirts and shorts town of Balboa. The prison's main star was a charismatic sandal-clad folk singer named Tim Morgan, who was so popular that for several months in Southern California, his record outsold the Beatles' A Hard Day's Night. My Monday night audition at the prison was marginal, but because the opening acts were usually marginal anyway, I was hired for a weekend tryout. I now had my first job outside Knott's Berry Farm, which presented a particular difficulty. It was one thing to do 5 minutes at the Birdcage, or 10 minutes at a hoot, but it was another thing to do 20 minutes for paying customers. Furiously trying to expand the act before my 3-day gig, I threw in earnest readings of the poets E.E. Cummings, T.S. Eliot, Carl Sandburg, and Stephen Vincent Benet, all aimed at stretching my act to show length. Nobody cared about hearing Eliot and Cummings in a nightclub, but the Benet piece, a Sacco narrative poem about a fiddle contest in Georgia, stayed in the act for at least a year until I canned it. Opening night, I stood in the parking lot behind the club, going over my material and warming up on the banjo. Adjacent to garbage cans and blowing with beach sand, the parking lot was where the opening acts tuned up and rehearsed, as there was no place else to practice out of the audience's earshot. I performed to a sparse crowd, among them my college friend Phil Carey, his brothers, and their dates. How did it go? I have no idea. My only memories of it are the unsettling echoes of chairs screeching on the concrete floor as patrons adjusted their seats. After the show, I was informed by my college friends that I had mispronounced the word incomparable. I now had 2 credits, the Birdcage and the Prison of Socrates. My Disneyland credit was not quite professional. And I was able to land intermittent jobs, among them the Ice House in Pasadena, which had been converted from, guess what, an ice house. Many earnest folk musicians appeared there, strumming guitars and wearing shirts with puffy sleeves. At the Ice House, I faced a real nightclub audience and performed almost as frequently as I did at the Birdcage. 3 shows a night was standard at these small clubs. Eventually, I ingratiated myself with enough venues that I wondered if I could possibly finance my life without the security of my steady job at Knott's Berry Farm. Having no agent or any hopes of finding one, I could not audition for movies or television or even learn where auditions were held. I didn't know about trade papers, Variety or The Hollywood Reporter, from which I might have gathered some information. I lived in suburbia at a time when a 1-hour drive to Los Angeles in my first great car, a white 1957 Chevy Bel Air, which, despite its beauty, guzzled quarts of oil and spewed it back into the air in the form of white smoke, seemed like a trip across the continent in a Conestoga wagon. But the local folk clubs thrived on single acts, and as usual, their Monday nights were reserved for budding talent. Stand-up comedy felt like an open door. It was possible to assemble a few minutes of material and be on stage that week, as opposed to standing in line in some mysterious world in Hollywood, getting no response, no phone calls returned, and no opportunity to perform. On Mondays, I could tour around Orange County, visit 3 clubs in one night, and be on stage, live, in front of an audience. If I flopped at the Paradox in Tustin, I might succeed an hour later at the Rouge et Noir. I found myself confining the magic to its own segment so I wouldn't be called a magician, even though the idea of doing comedy had sounded risky when I compared it to the safety of doing trick after trick. I wanted, needed, to be called a comedian. I discovered it was not magic I was interested in, but performing in general. Why? Was I in competition with my father? No, because I wasn't aware of his interest in show business until years later. Was my ego out of control and looking for glory? I don't think so. I am fundamentally shy and still feel slightly embarrassed at disproportionate attention. My answer to the question is simple. Who wouldn't want to be in show business? I looked around the birdcage and saw actors who had worked there 15 years and counting, and I knew it could be a trap for me. With some trepidation, I gave notice. Stormy was gone, Kathy was gone, John Stewart and Paul Shackleton were gone too, so there were no actual tearful goodbyes. Handshakes with George and Woody. At age 21, 3 years after I had started at the birdcage, I slipped away almost unnoticed. I continued to attend Long Beach State College, taking Stormy-inspired courses in metaphysics, ethics, and logic. New and exhilarating words such as epistemology, ontology, pragmatism, and existentialism, words whose definitions alone were stimulating, swirled through my head and reconfigured my thinking. One semester I was taking philosophy of language, continental rationalism, whatever that is, what, Descartes, history of ethics, and to complete the group, self-defense, which I found especially humiliating when, one afternoon in class, I was nearly beaten up by a girl wearing boxing gloves. A course in music appreciation focused me on classical music, causing me to miss the pop music of my own era, so I got into the Beatles several years late. I was fixated on studying, and even though I kept my outside jobs, my drive for learning led to a significant improvement from my dismal high school grade average. I was now an A student. I switched to cotton pants called peggers because I had vowed to grow up in abandoned jeans. My look was strictly wholesome Baptist. A friend lent me some comedy records. There were 3 by Nichols and May, several by Lenny Bruce, and 1 by Tom Lehrer, the great song parodist. Mike Nichols and Elaine May recorded without an audience, and I fixated on every nuance. Their comedy was sometimes created by only a subtle vocal shift. "Tell me, Dr. Schweitzer, what is this reverence for life?" Lenny Bruce, on the records I heard, was doing mostly non-political bits that were hilarious. Warden at a prison riot. "We're giving in to your demands, men! Accept the vibrators!" Tom Lehrer influenced me with one bizarre joke. "My brother Henry was a nonconformist. To show you what a nonconformist he was, he spelled his name H-E-N-3-R-Y. Some people fall asleep at night listening to music. I fell asleep to Lenny, Tom, and Mike and Elaine. These albums broke ground and led me to a Darwinian discovery. Comedy could evolve. On campus, I experienced 2 moments of illumination, both appropriately occurring in the bright sun. Now comfortable with indulging in overthinking, I was walking across the quad when a thought came to me, one that was nearly devastating. To implement the new concept called originality, that I had been first introduced to in Showmanship for Magicians, and was now presenting itself again in my classes in literature, poetry, and philosophy, I would have to write everything in the act myself. Any line or idea with even a vague feeling of familiarity or provenance had to be expunged. There could be nothing that made the audience feel they weren't seeing something utterly new. This unfortunate fact mortified me. I did not know how to write comedy at all. But I did know I would have to drop some of my best one-liners, all pilfered from gag books, and consequently lose 10 minutes from my already strained act. Even worse, I would have to lose another prime gag I lifted, Carl Ballantyne's never-fail Appearing Dove, which had been appropriated by almost every comic magician under the age of 20. Ballantyne would blow up a paper bag and announce that he was going to produce a dove. "Come out flying," he would say. Then he would pop the bag with his hands, and an anemic flutter of feathers would poof out from the sack. The thought of losing all this material was depressing because, after several years of working up my weak 20 minutes, I was now starting from almost zero. I came up with several schemes for developing material. I laugh in life, I thought, so why not observe what it was that made me laugh? And if I did spot something that was funny, I decided not to just describe it as happening to someone else, but to translate it into the first person, so it was happening to me. A guy didn't walk into a bar, I did. I didn't want it to appear that others were nuts. I wanted it to appear that I was nuts. Another method was to idly and abstractly dream up bits. Sitting in a science class, I stared at the periodic table of the elements that hung behind the professor. That weekend, I went on stage at the Ice House and announced, "And now I would like to do a dramatic reading of the periodic table of the elements." "Fee-oh-he," I said. That bit didn't last long. In logic class, I opened my textbook, the last place I was expecting to find comic inspiration, and was startled to find that Lewis Carroll, the supremely witty author of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, was also a logician. He wrote logic textbooks and included argument forms based on the syllogism, normally presented in logic books like this. All men are mortal. Socrates is a man. Therefore, Socrates is mortal. But Carroll's were more convoluted, and they struck me as funny in a new way. Babies are illogical. Nobody is despised who can manage a crocodile. Illogical persons are despised. Therefore, babies cannot manage crocodiles. And no interesting poems are unpopular among people of real taste. No modern poetry is free from affectation. All your poems are on the subject of soap bubbles. No affected poetry is popular among people of taste. Only a modern poem would be on the subject of soap bubbles. Therefore, all your poems are uninteresting. These word games bothered and intrigued me. Appearing to be silly nonsense, on examination, they were absolutely logical, yet they were still funny. The comedy doors opened wide, and Lewis Carroll's clever fancies from the 19th century expanded my definition of what comedy could be. I began closing my show by announcing, "I'm not going home tonight. I'm going to Banana Land, a place where only two things are true. Only two things. One, all chairs are green. And two, no chairs are green." Not at Lewis Carroll's level, but the line worked for my contemporaries, and I loved implying that the one thing I believed in was a contradiction. I also was enamored of the rhythmic poetry of E.E. Cummings, and a tantalizing quote from one of his recorded lectures stayed in my head. When asked why he became a poet, he said, "Like the burlesque comedian, I am abnormally fond of that precision which creates movement." The line, with its intriguing reference to comedy, was enigmatic, and it took me 10 years to work out its meaning. The second illuminating moment occurred when I was walking to class from a parking lot so far from campus that I could see the curvature of the earth. Again, under the bright California sun, I saw a girl with short black hair, pertly walking in faded blue jeans. I was nervous about saying hello, but she offered me a welcoming smile that said it was okay. She had an unmelodic name, Nina Goldblatt, and she was a professional dancer. We started running into each other accidentally at every opportunity. I only had to get over the hurdle of her dating the handsome actor Vince Edwards, who played the TV doctor Ben Casey, and who was sending limos down to Long Beach to chauffeur her to Hollywood. Somehow I did, and a new romance was on. Nina was a dancer in the Mickey Finn Show, a banjo and pizza whoop-de-doo, with an upcoming appearance in Las Vegas on the Fabled Strip. I drove 5 hours to spend the weekend with her and was captivated by the city. But my excitement was dampened by having only $4 in my pocket. I was so broke that when I hit a nickel slot for 50 cents, it momentarily changed the quality of my life. It was Nina who had the dough, and we learned that Vegas could support even the poorly healed by offering $1.25 all-you-can-eat buffets. Nina treated me to some Vegas nightclubs, and I fantasized about starring as a lounge act at a spiffy hotel. We went to see the Jets, a two-man comedy music team whose gags included passing through the audience using the microphone as a falsy detector. I enjoyed my time with Nina. She was funny and saucy as well as cute, and 1 year later, she was to have a significant effect on my professional life. My college roommate, Phil Carey, was an artist and musician. He sang bass, not in a barbershop quartet, but for a sophisticated chorale that featured music with complicated rhythms and mismatched 12-tone arrangements. Phil's contagious enthusiasm got me excited about art, particularly the avant-garde, and we quickly noted that the campus art scene was also a great arena to meet girls. We loved reading magazine reports of New York galleries stuffed with Warhol's Brillo boxes and giant flowers, Lichtenstein's cartoon panels, and throngs of people dressed in black. One afternoon I donned Phil's beret, which meant I was disguised as an artist, and sneaked into his life drawing class, where an attractive nude blonde was casually displaying herself. I was all business on the outside, but on the inside I was shouting, "Yee-haw!" Phil had a developed sense of humor. His cat was named Miles, and when asked if the cat was named after Miles Davis, Phil would say, "No, it was, and miles to go before I sleep." Working on a college project, Phil landed an interview with the great American composer Aaron Copland. However, he would have to drive from Los Angeles to Peekskill, New York to conduct it. I jumped at the chance to go along. In the summer of 1966, I was still 20 and proud that I would make it to New York City before I turned 21. We installed a makeshift cot in the back of my coughing blue windowless VW bus, and we drove across America without stopping. I was trying to write like E.E. Cummings, so my correspondence to Nina, all highly romantic, goopy, and filled with references to flowers and stars, read like amateur versions of his poems. Nina saved the letters, but they are too embarrassing to reproduce here. 3 days after we left Los Angeles, Phil and I arrived at Aaron Copland's house, a low-slung A-frame with floor-to-ceiling windows set in a dappled forest by the road. We knocked on the door, Copland answered it, and over his shoulder we saw a group of men sitting in the living room wearing only skimpy black thongs. He escorted us to his flagstone patio, where I had the demanding job of turning the tape recorder on and off while Phil asked questions about Copland's musical process. We emerged a half hour later with the coveted interview and got in the car, never mentioning the men in skimpy black thongs because, like trigonometry, we just didn't quite comprehend it. We drove to West Reading, Connecticut, for a tour of the house of another great American composer, the late Charles Ives. Speaking with Ives' son-in-law, George Tyler, we learned the peculiar fact that Ives was an avant-garde composer by night and an insurance agent by day. After a detour to Cambridge, Massachusetts, to cruise the home of my idol Cummings, we drove into glorious Manhattan. Saucer-eyed, we hustled over to the Museum of Modern Art, where we saw, among the Cezannes and Matisses, Dalí's famous painting of melting clocks, the shockingly tiny, the persistence of memory. We were dismayed to find that Warhol and Lichtenstein had not yet been ordained. We drove to 8th Avenue, and Phil circled the block while I retrieved from the imposing central New York post office a lively and welcome letter from Nina, sent to me care of General Delivery, New York City. I bounded down the massive steps, waving the onion skin envelope aloft for Phil to see, as though it were the lost map of the Incas. Before we left Cambridge, I sent this postcard to Nina. "Dear Nina, today, about an hour ago, I stood in front of E. E. Cummings' home at Harvard. His wife is still living there. We saw her. But the most fantastic thing was when we asked directions to Irving Street. The person we asked said to tell Mrs. Cummings hello from the Jameses. She turned out to be William James's great-granddaughter." Then I added, "I have decided my act is going to go avant-garde. It is the only way to do what I want." I'm not sure what I meant, but I wanted to use the lingo, and it was seductive to make these pronouncements. Through the years, I have learned there is no harm in charging oneself up with delusions between moments of valid inspiration. At the Ice House, I had met the comedian George McKelvey. George had an actual career and was quite funny. In reference to radio's invisible crime fighter, The Shadow, he would ask, "If you could be invisible, what would you do? Fight crime?" He was in Aspen, Colorado during spring break, about to work a small folk club, when he broke his leg skiing. "Could I fill in for him?" he asked. He generously offered me all of his salary, I think it was $300 for the 2 weeks, which would be more than I had ever earned anywhere, anytime. I was 21 years old in March of 1967 when I headed for the notorious ski resort. I arrived at a Panabode house, a cedar cabin made from a kit just outside Aspen. Visiting entertainers were bunked there, and after I made my way through the crunchy snow and stowed my suitcase under my bed, several of us introduced ourselves. One was my co-bill, John McClure, a lanky guitarist with an acute sense of humor. Wandering in later was a pretty waitress named Linda Byers, who, I assumed, would fall for me because of my carefully designed poetry-quoting artist persona, but who, to my shock, chose John, and they formed a long-term relationship. Also in the house was one of the few English comedians working in America, Jonathan Moore, who played a bagpipe to open his show, scaring the audience with its ancient howl as he entered the club from behind them. Jonathan was older than we were, had been around, wore sunglasses indoors, and had the charm of a well-spoken cynic. His sheepdog, an ecstatic ball-chasing mop named Winston, dove repeatedly into the deep snowy banks to retrieve our enthusiastically thrown snowballs. Winston didn't seem to mind that they would vanish white on white, and he earnestly pursued the impossible, digging, digging, digging. Jonathan Moore also said something in passing that put my hypochondriacal senses on alert. A local Aspenite had died, and Jonathan offered, "You can't live at this altitude with a bad heart." From then on, whenever I was in Aspen, I had a barely manageable fear that I would suddenly be struck down. The nightclub, the Abbey Cellar on Galena Street, was at basement level in the middle of town and hard to find even for us. John and I, in order to drum up business, left little cards on the table in the upstairs restaurant that read, "Steve Martin, John McClure, Entertainment Ordinaire," which to me was hilariously funny, but never seemed to be noticed as a joke. Aspen was no place for poetry readings, and they were stripped permanently from my act. I was now doing my triptych of banjo playing, comedy, and magic. One evening at the Abbey Cellar, I had my first experience with a serious heckler who, sitting at the front table with his wife and another straight-looking couple, stood up and said, "See if you think this is funny," and threw a glass of red wine on me. The problem for him was, at this point in the evening, the employees outnumbered the audience. A few seconds later, John McClure and the rough, tough bartender, an Irishman named Mike, appeared like centurions and escorted him out. Eventually, his friends slunk out, too. The expulsion had a downside. The audience was now one-third as large and in shock, and remained in stunned silence for the rest of my show. Later, I developed a few defensive lines to use against the unruly. "Oh, I remember when I had my first beer." And if that didn't cool them off, I would use a psychological trick. I would lower my voice and continue with my act, talking almost inaudibly. The audience couldn't hear the show, and they would shut the heckler up on their own. I was in awe of the red-bearded Mike, who seemed so confident in the divided world of Aspen, where locals with a sense of entitlement were pitted against developers with a sense of condominiums. One evening after closing, I watched him crack open an amyl nitrate, a potent drug for the heart and a dangerous one to fool around with, but rumored to enhance sex. With a long, deep breath, he inhaled its fumes in one nostril, then did the same extended inhale through the other nostril. "Do you want some? It only lasts a few seconds," he said. Not really, but I leaned over and with the ampule held far away from my nose, gave it the most tentative sniff possible. My brain exploded. I walked around the club feeling like a colossus with a 4-foot-wide light bulb where my head was supposed to be. Alarmed and anxious, I went sliding into the icy streets, trying to calm down. As for it lasting seconds, I was still vibrating 24 hours later. What, I wondered, must Mike feel as he inhaled the freshly broken capsule into both lungs with an effort worthy of the big bad wolf? The next night I was picked up by a local woman. She was older and looking for sex, and since my boyfriend's status with Nina had recently unraveled, I was eager to oblige. Even though I was still reeling from the previous night, we went to her second-floor apartment in a 100-year-old building and wasted no time. In the middle of this experience, I heard the pop of an amyl nitrate, and then she shoved it toward my nose. I had barely come down from the previous night's blast, and I wasn't about to have my head ripped off again. I breathed out and tried to make it appear as though I were breathing in, determined that none of the molecules should get anywhere near me. I was successful, but had to act as though I was wowed beyond belief Yes, yes, I lied. After this mess was over, she asked if she could take my picture. I said sure, and she went to get her camera. I moved into her living room where I casually picked up from her coffee table a wood-bound scrapbook bearing the image of a sleeping Mexican on its cover. Pasted inside were dozens of photos of guys sitting in the chair I was now occupying. My experience at the Abbey Cellar was important to me, but not as important as what was going on after hours. John and I shared a room, and his future partner, Linda, would join us for lengthy chats. What we discussed was the new zeitgeist. I don't know how it got into this bedroom in Aspen, but it was creeping everywhere simultaneously. I didn't yet know its name, but found out later it was called Flower Power, and I was excited to learn that we were now living in the Age of Aquarius, an age when, at least astrologically, the world would be taken over by macrame. Anti-corporate, individual, and freak-based, it proposed that all we had to do was love each other, and there would be no more wars or strife. Nothing could have been newer or more appealing. The vast numbers of us who changed our thoughts and lives for this belief proved that, yes, it is possible to fool all of the people all of the time. The word love was being tossed around as though only we insiders knew its definition. But any new social philosophy is good for creativity. New music was springing up, new graphics twisted and swirled as if on LSD, and an older generation was being glacially inched aside to make room for the freshly weaned new one. The art world, always contrarian, responded to psychedelia with monochrome and minimalism. It was fun trying to turn a young conservative, which was easy because our music was better. I remember trying to convince a member of the Dallas Ski Club that Yummy Yummy Yummy, I've Got Love in My Tummy was not really a good song no matter how much he liked it. After 2 weeks in Aspen, I went back to Los Angeles feeling like an anointed prophet, taking my friends aside and burping out the new philosophy. I continued to pursue my studies and half believed I might try for a doctorate in philosophy and become a teacher, as teaching is, after all, a form of show business. I'm not sure what the purpose of fooling myself was, but I toyed with the idea for several semesters. I concluded that not to continue with comedy would place a question in my mind that would nag me for the rest of my life. Could I have had a career in performing? Everything was dragging me toward the arts. Even the study of modern philosophy suggested that philosophy was nonsense. A classmate, Ron Barnett, and I spent hours engaged in late-night mind-altering dialogues in laundromats and parking lots discussing Ludwig Wittgenstein, the great Austrian semanticist. Wittgenstein's investigations disallowed so many types of philosophical discussions that we were convinced the very discussion we were having was impossible. Soon I felt that a career in the irrational world of creativity not only made sense, but had moral purpose. I was living several lives at once. I was a student at Long Beach State, I sometimes filled in at the Birdcage Theater, and at night I performed in various folk clubs with an eclectic homemade comedy act that wasn't to reach its flashpoint for another decade. One of the clubs I played was Leadbetter's, a comparatively classy beer and wine night spot a few blocks from UCLA that catered to the college crowd. I was taken under the wing of its owner, Randy Sparks, a theatrical entrepreneur who had founded the New Christy Minstrels, a highly successful folk act. I opened the show for his new acts, the Back Porch Majority and the New Society, two massive stage-filling folk groups who offered wholesome high spirits and some pretty funny comedy to the Westwood Village audiences. Fats Johnson, a jovial folk singer who dressed to kill in black suits with white ruffled shirts and wore elaborate rings on his guitar-strumming hand, often headlined the club. When I asked him about his philosophy of dressing for the stage, he said firmly, "Always look better than they do." Now that most of my work was in Westwood, Long Beach State College, 40 miles away, seemed like Siberia. I transferred to my third college, UCLA, so I could be closer to the action, and I took several courses there. One was an acting class, the kind that feels like prison camp and treats students like detainees who need to be broken. Another was a course in television writing, which seemed practical. I also continued my studies in philosophy. I had done pretty well in symbolic logic at Long Beach, so I signed up for advanced symbolic logic at my new school. Saying that I was studying advanced symbolic logic at UCLA had a nice ring. What had been nerdy in high school now had mystique. However, I went to class the first day and discovered that UCLA used a different set of symbols from those I had learned at Long Beach. To catch up, I added a class in Logic 101, which meant I was studying beginning logic and advanced logic at the same time. I was overwhelmed and shocked to find that I couldn't keep up. I had reached my math limit as well as my philosophy limit. I abruptly changed my major to theater and, free from the workload of my logic classes, took a relaxing inhale of crisp California air. But on the exhale, I realized I was now investing in no other future but show business. The physical distance from each other had permanently broken up Nina and me, and she had left school to pursue her dancing career. But overnight, there were dozens of new people in my life. Pot smoking was de rigueur, this being the 60s, and since I was now a regular at Ledbetter's, I was living rent-free over the garage of a mansion in the exclusive area of Bel Air, thanks to the generosity of Randy Sparks and his wife Diane. Even though I was armed with a comedy act that was at best hit and miss, I was fearless and ready to go. Among the crowd of singers and musicians whose local fame I assumed was worldwide was a sylph-like figure, a non-singer and non-musician who nonetheless seemed to be regarded quite highly in this small showbiz matrix. Her name was Melissa, but her friends called her Mitzi. She was 20 years old, with a Katharine Hepburn beauty and a similarly willowy frame. She was intelligent, energetic, and lit from inside. Her hair was ash brown, and always at the end of one of her long and slender arms was a Nikon camera with a lens the size of a can of Campbell's soup. After a few months, her current romance withered, and Mitzi and I became entwined. After several weeks of courtship, Mitzi invited me to her parents' house for dinner. Mitzi's last name was Trumbo. Her father was Dalton Trumbo, the blacklisted screenwriter and one of the notorious Hollywood Ten, a group of writers and directors who were censored during the Red Scare of the early 50s. During his congressional hearing, Trumbo vociferously challenged the right of his inquisitors to interrogate him, prompting a frustrated committee member to scream, "You are out of order, sir! You are out of order!" in a futile attempt to get him to shut up. It was Trumbo who wrote the screenplays for Spartacus, Lonely Are the Brave, Hawaii, Exodus, and Papillon, whose personal letters read like Swiftian essays, who had to flee to Mexico for several years and write under pseudonyms such as Sam Jackson and James Bonham in order to escape McCarthyism, and whom, at this stage in my tunneled vision life, I had never heard of. Mitzi later told me that there were no wrong numbers in her household, because any unknown name the caller asked for was assumed to be one of Trumbo's aliases. From my perspective, Mitzi was a sophisticate. She had traveled, she was politically aware and had attended Reed College in Oregon, a bastion of liberal thought. Her intelligence was informed by her family history. When I went to dinner at her home in the Hollywood Hills, I did not know that the few months I would spend in this family's graces would broaden my life. My first glimpse of Dalton Trumbo revealed an engrossed intellect, not finessing his latest screenplay, but sorting the seeds from the stems of a brick of pot. "Pop smokes marijuana," Mitzi explained, with the wishful thought of cutting down on his drinking. Sometimes, from their balcony, I would see Trumbo walking laps around the perimeter of the pool. He held a small counter in one hand and clicked it every time he passed the diving board. These health walks were compromised by the cigarette he constantly held in his other hand. Dalton Trumbo was the first raconteur I ever met. The family dinners, frequented by art dealers, actors, and artists of all kinds, including the screenwriters Hugo Butler and Ring Lardner Jr., and the director George Roy Hill, were lively, political, and funny. I had never been in a house where conversations were held during dinner or where food was placed before me after being prepared behind closed doors. It was also the first time I ever heard swear words spoken by adults in front of their offspring. Lyndon Johnson's Vietnam bombing policy dominated the conversation, and the government's iron-fisted response to war protesters rankled the dinner guests, since the Hollywood Ten were long familiar with oppression. Trumbo had a patriarchal delivery whether he was on a rant or discussing art or slinging wit, but nothing he said was elitist, though I do remember him saying, as he spread his arms to indicate the china and silver serving ladles, "Admittedly, we do live well." Trumbo's wife, Cleo, beautiful like Mitzi, was at the head of the table when Trumbo was downstairs writing. Cleo was the person actually in charge and could not have been more welcoming. She extended an open dinner invitation to Mitzi and me, and as I was deeply broke, we always accepted. The food was delicious and the company spectacular, so we did not regret missing out on the health salads served at our local incense-burning restaurants, gunky concoctions of cheese-laden, ham-draped iceberg lettuce doused with creamy dressing. One evening after dinner, we adjourned to the living room, something else I had never done before, and I was surprised to see a marijuana cigarette passed among the guests. The joint finally got to Trumbo, and he clasped it between his knuckles like a German officer in a movie. He didn't pass it along, just held it and puffed on it, but did not inhale. With a broad grin, Mitzi leaned over to me and said, "Pop doesn't know how to smoke pot. He thinks you smoke it like a cigar and he never gets high." The family's liberal bent was never fully tested. When I asked Mitzi if her parents knew about my slipping in the garden door of her bedroom late at night and leaving at daybreak, she said that Cleo knew, but Pop would not be pleased. Hence, in the early mornings, I started my car gingerly, thinking that if I turned the key slowly, the engine would not make so much noise. The Trumbo house was modern, built on a hillside, and extended down three floors into a ravine. The walls in the living room were large, and they give me my most vivid memory of the house, for they were covered with art. Political art. I had never seen real paintings in a house, and this might have been where my own inclination toward owning pictures began. In the entry was an 8-foot-high Baconesque painting by Hiram Williams, a picture of several businessmen, their hands bloody, emerging from a white background. In the dining room was a William Gropper, depicting members of the House Un-American Activities Committee, grotesquely outlined in fluorescent green against a murky background. There was a Raphael Sawyer, a Moses Sawyer, and a Jack Levine painting of Hindenburg making Hitler chancellor. These artists are obscure today but not forgotten. Gropper's art depicted politicos as porcine bullies, and Jack Levine's well-brushed social realism had a biting edge and fit the politics of the family perfectly. Mitzi became my official photographer, and she snapped dozens of rolls of film, all to find the perfect publicity photo. It being the 60s, there were many shots of me with a flower on my head or a daisy between my teeth. We spent one morning taking photos in Ferndale, where a stream flowed down the concrete center of a man-made mini-tropical rainforest set in the heart of Los Angeles, which up to that point was the most lush place I had ever seen. Later that day, we attended an anti-Vietnam War protest where I was lucky enough to get, then unlucky enough to lose, my draft card autographed by Cassius Clay, soon to be the most famous person in the world, Muhammad Ali. The war was rapidly consuming young men, and the draft was closing in. The thought of being shipped off to Vietnam for possible dismemberment scared me, especially after I read Dalton Trumbo's anti-war book, Johnny Got His Gun, the story of a young soldier who wakes to discover he has lost his legs, arms, mouth, nose, eyes, and ears, and is left with only the ability to think. In the face of this war, which snared so many, I had a case of rolling luck. First, I was exempt because I was in college. When the college deferment lifted, I became 1Y, unacceptable because of migraine headaches, which I had exaggerated. When the definition of 1Y was tightened, and I was moved up to 1A, the draft went to a lottery, and I drew a middling number. As my number approached, the Army went to all volunteer, and I was saved from an alternate life. But I cannot end this story without a solemn bow to those who weren't so fortunate. I got a one-show job performing near the Russian River in Northern California. I drove there in my second great car, a yellow 1966 Ford Mustang. My third and last great car was a yellow 1967 Jaguar XKE. Then I lost all interest in cars. Up north, I reconnoitered with Mitzi and she took photos of me canoeing. Unfortunately, she didn't photograph the job I had, performing at a drive-in theater at 3 p.m. under the afternoon sun, while a dozen cars hooked up to the sound system listened through window speakers. If the drive-in patrons thought a joke was funny, they honked. You might think I'm exaggerating, but I'm not. Once on the way to the Trumbo house, Mitzi warned me, "Pop's in a bad mood today. He's got a screenplay due in 4 days and he hasn't started it yet." The screenplay was for the movie The Fixer, starring Alan Bates. Eventually the work got done and the movie was ready to shoot. Trumbo encouraged Mitzi to join him, and she was whisked off to Budapest for the duration of the film. After I received several charming letters from her and then noticed a lag in the regularity of their arrival, Mitzi sent me a gentle and direct Dear John letter. She had been swept away by the director John Frankenheimer, who, 20 years later, tried and failed to seduce my then-wife, the actress Victoria Tennant, whom he was directing in a movie. Mitzi was simply too alluring to be left alone in a foreign country, and I was too hormonal to be left alone in Hollywood. Incidentally, Frankenheimer died a few years ago, but it was not I who killed him. Television. I was still 21 when I was politely booted from Randy and Diane Sparks' garage apartment. I moved to an unincorporated area called Palms, adjacent to the historic MGM Studios, and shared a small guest house with the sharp, deadpan comedian Gary Muldeer, I think we should put pictures of missing transvestites on cartons of Half and Half, and the lonely voice singer-guitarist Michael Johnson. I continued to work at Leadbetter's and attend classes at UCLA, but while I studied half-heartedly in Westwood, Nina had entered the world of real show business. She had changed her name to the more mellifluous Nina Lawrence and landed a job dancing on the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, the hippest thing on television and flower-powered all over the place. She had begun dating Mason Williams, the head writer on the show. I still had an affectionate crush on her and was glad for her and sick all at the same time. Mason Williams, exuberant, infused with creativity, and the future composer of the smash hit Classical Gas, drove an elegant 1938 Pierce Arrow and could talk the new aesthetic, essentially the appreciation for all things quirky and creative, much better than I could. Where I could only recite poetry, Mason actually was a poet. He lived in a rented house in the Hollywood Hills with sparkling views of Los Angeles out the bedroom's vast picture window. I imagined Mason and Nina doing it every which away for anyone with a pair of binoculars to see. But these days, who could mind? We weren't a couple anymore, and free love, man, free love, which, by the way, was the single greatest concept a young man has ever heard. There was a time when intercourse, or some version of it, was a way of saying hello. About 3 years later, women got wise, and my frustration returned to normal levels. I was almost but not quite in a financial bind when Nina phoned me to say that the Smothers Brothers, exercising the slogan of the day, never trust anyone over 30, wanted to experiment and hire a few young writers for their hit TV show. In college, influenced by Jack Douglas's book, My Brother Was an Only Child, and Mason Williams' The Mason Williams Reading Matter, I had composed, as a defiant alternative to coherent essay writing, some goofy one-paragraph stories with such titles as The Day the Dopes Came Over, What to Say When the Ducks Show Up, and Cruel Shoes. Nina told me to send over my stories. I did, and she gave them to Mason. The collection of scraps I sent was sketchy, half-baked material that I would never have submitted to a college English class for fear of expulsion. But Mason liked it, or maybe he just liked Nina. And having never written anything professionally in my life, I was hired as a tryout for the few remaining weeks of the Smothers season. I gingerly went to my television writing instructor at UCLA and told him I had to resign from the class and school because I had gotten a job writing for television. Years later, I learned that because my material had not made it past the final judges at the top, Mason, in an act of artistic generosity, had paid this newcomer out of his own pocket. My professional writing career started off painfully. The older writers were rightfully suspicious of this kid, especially since my only qualification was being under 30, and I felt the pressure to deliver. I was timid and unsure of myself in this suddenly wider world. If I was asked to write an intro for the folk singer Judy Collins, I would write, "And now, ladies and gentlemen, here's folk singer Judy Collins." One afternoon, I was in the studio watching a rehearsal of a sketch dealing with television. Tommy Smothers came up to me and said directly, "We need an intro for this bit. Can you write it?" This question was put to me with a clear implication that my job was on the line. I said yes, but meant no. I went upstairs to my office as if I were on a march to the gallows. My mind was blank, blanker than blank. I was a tabula rasa. I put paper in the typewriter and impotently stared at it. Finally, a great line occurred to me, except it belonged to my roommate, the comedian Gary Muldeer. But it was perfect for this intro, so why not call him and ask if I could use it? By a miracle, he was home. I explained that I was stuck. He said, "Sure, use it." I went downstairs, handed in the line, and Dick Smothers read the joke. It has been proven that more Americans watch television than any other appliance. Two highly experienced writers, Hal Goodman and Al Goldman, with credits extending back to Jack Benny, came up to me and said, "Did you write that joke?" "Yes," I said. "Good work," they said. If at that moment I had been hooked up to a lie detector, it would have spewed smoke. The event must have been cathartic, because afterward I relaxed, and I was able to contribute fully to the show. The season ended, and I was asked to work on a summer replacement show, the malappropriately titled The Summer Brothers Smother Show, starring Glenn Campbell. Glenn was a former studio musician who had just risen to stardom with his first big hit, John Hartford's Gentle on My Mind. I was 22 years old when I found myself standing in a small room at CBS on Fairfax with a few other writers, including John Hartford, while Pete Seeger strummed his banjo not 5 feet from me. Around the calfskin head of Pete's banjo was written in ink, "This machine surrounds hate and forces it to surrender," an allusion to Woody Guthrie's earlier guitar slogan, "This machine kills fascists." We pitched concepts for Pete's appearance, but his idea was the best. He would sing, "Waist deep in the big muddy, and the big fool says to push on," over images of the increasingly tragic war in Vietnam. Glenn Campbell probably hadn't known what he was getting into, but he endorsed us all the way. I was teamed with the hilarious Bob Einstein, an advertising writer who had found his way to CBS, and fortunately, as we shared a windowless office and worked together 14 hours a day, we became inseparable friends. Bob and I were perfect writing foils. We had a mutual regard for Laurel and Hardy, Jerry Lewis, Daffy Duck, and Mel Blanc's peculiar genius, and we could make each other laugh until we were breathless. If I accidentally banged my head on a stage pipe, Bob would collapse in hysterics, and following his lead, so would I. At least 8 of our 14 hours were spent laughing until we were in pain, then trying to decide if what we were laughing at was usable or just comic delirium. Bob later achieved fame as Super Dave, a bumbling TV daredevil. Though Bob and I were a team, I sometimes worked with another young writer-performer, Rob Reiner, later to make his mark as the director of, among other films, When Harry Met Sally and the classic This Is Spinal Tap. Rob, in a coincidence that was yet to happen, was the son of my future film director, Carl Reiner. Rob and I closed our first season with a strong finish. We wrote a 10-minute finale combining short sketches with classic rock songs from the 50s. At that time, Oldies But Goodies was a new concept. The segment was a hit, and Rob and I gave ourselves credit, whether it was accurate or not, for starting a 50s music revival. We wrote it for Glenn Campbell and Bobby Gentry, who was still riding on the success of Ode to Billy Joe. And when Bobby appeared on stage in an itsy-bitsy teeny-weeny yellow polka-dot bikini, all the writers' jaws dropped. We hadn't known she started as a chorus girl in Las Vegas. I had a short-lived but troublesome worry. What if writing comedy was a dead end because one day everything would have been done and we writers would just run out of stuff? I assuaged myself with my own homegrown homily. Comedy is a distortion of what is happening, and there will always be something happening. This problem solved, I grew more confident as a writer and slid into steady work the following season, thanks to an endorsement from Bob Einstein on the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour. I even had a few walk-on appearances where I inevitably played the hippie. The satirical show had taken a big left turn, which suited my politics perfectly. Constantly making news because of CBS's censorship policy, the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour was the only source on primetime television for both satire and contemporary music acts, such as The Doors and The Beatles. Though my new writing job frequently required all-nighters, I continued to service my stand-up career. I would bomb regularly at the Ice House, but the audiences were so sparse that the proprietor, Bob Stain, couldn't tell if I was flopping or the house was too empty. One night I realized I had been on for 20 minutes and had not gotten a single laugh from the dead Tuesday night crowd. I thought, why not go for the record? I set my mind to it and finished the show without having roused one snicker. However, there was a sign of encouragement from these early jobs, and years later I heard it phrased perfectly by Bill Cosby. He said that early in his career, when the audience wasn't laughing, he could hear the waitresses laughing, and they saw the show night after night. I noticed that the waitresses were laughing. My life had been alternately inching or leaping upward. I was proud of my job on the Smothers Brothers show. I had some cash. My sex life was abundant and selfish. Things were rolling along nicely when I experienced a crushing psychological surprise. One night I was off to the